Group meeting, Friday, 7th December, 1984. In groups like ours, there comes the time when each one of us should try to be a light unto the world. Because year after year, we have gone through the process, a process of catharsis, freeing the psyche and the brain from all kinds of ideas and beliefs and convictions and so forth, freeing ourselves from bias, prejudice, preconceptions, assumptions, and the conditioning imposed upon us by parents, teachers, friends, the country as a whole, and so forth. Now, we have had practically 22 complete years, and in February it will be the 23rd year. But each one of us should, I feel, try to realize that with the process of purification and with the inward growth and the development of consciousness, one has to be a light to the world. But this does not mean that one will deliberately set out to be a light to the world. That would be rather an egoistic conceit. Every one of us radiates an influence on the world by what we actually are. Now, we all know that our conditioning and our experience, our study, our self-observation and self-control and so forth has a certain, let us hope, good result in bringing about change in us in the right way. The change which means that the restricted, finite, temporal consciousness, which is our normal state of consciousness, is advancing towards a holistic consciousness, which will embrace all humanity ultimately. So, we cannot deliberately set out to do this. All growth has to be a natural process. I have said this sort of thing several times. When we are born, we cannot determine at birth that, oh, I shall become this, that and the other, I shall grow in this, that and the other way, and so on and so on. We can't. It all happens naturally. Nature does all that for us, in fact, you see. Now, nature brings the body to maturity. Our personal task is to bring the psyche to maturity. And this involves the whole of religious living. And we have considered religious living in innumerable ways during these 22 years, haven't we? So, if we grow naturally and spontaneously, that is to say, if we allow ourselves to grow, allow the psychophysical organism to grow and release its full potentiality as far as is possible during our lifetime. If we do that, then our individual consciousness will advance towards that holistic consciousness, because of which there will be no separation whatsoever between what we call our own self and the whole of the world. We shall embrace all humanity, or at least we will be on the way to doing that, you see. Now, what is one of the principal significances of this? It is that by the living of the religious life, we become a light unto ourselves. We all know that our religious ideas, conceptions, beliefs have been imposed upon us by our particular culture and what has been handed down generation after generation by through our parents and grandparents and so on, all the way up to Adam, so to say. We are conditioned that way. We have never, or rather, very few of us have ever questioned this conditioning of so many beliefs and conceptions and so forth. If we question it, then we shall discover that the way religion has been presented in the world during the last 4,000 years at least is a ghastly mispresentation of religious truth. But we must beware of one thing. We cannot examine these religious teachings without at the same time trying to free ourselves from all our conditioning. This during the last year and a little more now, a year and 2 months, because we started in September 1983, we have been looking with a critical eye at so many of the teachings which originally started with Zarathustra, who laid them down. And his teachings influenced Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and to a certain extent Buddhism also. Historically, Buddhism also. Mahayana Buddhism particularly. Now, the idea laid down was that the individual has an immortal soul, just as we say that he has a house or he has a suit and so forth. Now, this immortal soul, as it is called, was supposed to be our own private property. Philosophers like John Locke, who was a great philosopher in his own way, postulated that the soul of man is a mental atom. John Locke was contemporaneous with Isaac Newton. And of course, the atomic theory had then come into vogue. John Locke, analyzing the mind and mental processes, declared the soul was a mental atom. And he declared, and this is where he went hopelessly wrong, he declared that each soul was entirely separate from everyone else, and it was the business of that soul to consider its own welfare and leave all other souls alone. So you see, this terrible sin, this terrible evil of the separative, isolative consciousness was intensified by philosophers like John Locke. Actually, some people in the Western world too, but they have borrowed it from the East, say that all mankind is one, all life is one. But they don't live by that saying, simply because they don't understand precisely what that means. I have tried to put before our groups the fact that we function in two contexts. Actually, only one context, but it is convenient to talk in terms of two contexts, because that one context functions so limitedly and so constrictedly in us that it's necessary to talk in terms of two contexts. We are aware in terms of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. I am I, separate from everything else. It is this terrible misconception that I am I, separate from everyone else, which is the root source of all the conflict, both within ourselves and with our fellow human beings and our whole environment. This is the root of it all, really. Well, as I said earlier, John Locke, the philosopher, was responsible for emphasizing this. And the other economists, like John Stuart Mill and a few others, also, and Jeremy Bentham, they talked in terms of the happiness of the many. And one should work for that happiness as such. But it was entirely related to a separate self. So now, one can never be a light unto oneself, leave alone one's environment and the world, as long as that terrible misconception prevails. And it is not only a misconception, it denotes a state of consciousness which is, to use Shakespearean language, cribbed, cabined, confined. It is terribly limited. We have to understand ourselves and purify ourselves sufficiently in order that we are conscious of existence in terms of a unitary whole. Now, as I said right in the beginning, we cannot say to ourselves, right, we'll go for this goal. It is not a goal in the ordinary sense of the term. Every goal is a limited something. But this holistic consciousness is a universal consciousness. It embraces the totality. And the word goal has no meaning whatsoever in terms of totality. Because a goal is something particular which we postulate. There's the goal, I'll go to that. It is a limited, finite thing. Belongs to the context of mortality, not of immortality. In consciousness, remember, there's no such thing as immortality for a separate, isolated, individual soul or spirit or whatever you call it. There is no such thing as a separate soul or a separate spirit. These words represent the universal, and the context of that universal is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. It is all pervasive. So, we have to face the question, in order to be a light to oneself, and thereby be naturally, without intending it, without any personal intention about it, you see, a light to the world, it is necessary to understand the purposes of our existence. There are several purposes, but we shall talk of only one or two. On page 216, the third paragraph, something from the second paragraph first. When you are the purified, perfected one, you are the transparent nexus for the free inflow and outflow of transcendence. Thus is purpose fulfilled through the temporal existence of you or me. Now we must clearly understand that this purpose can never be my purpose or your purpose. It is the fulfillment of transcendence through each and every one of us as instruments, as vehicles, living vehicles for that purpose, that evolutionary purpose of the development of human consciousness to its culminating point of holistic consciousness. Remember, there is nothing whatever of reward or gain for you or me in perpetuity. But the living of the holy life brings the truly desirable and the truly worthy condition of existence, essentially a peace of mind, an inward balance, an imperturbability which nothing can shake. If that imperturbability is there, it becomes easy to understand and appreciate the viewpoints and behavior of everyone else. If that inner calm and stability isn't there, we can't understand them. We quarrel with them. We say, no, you're wrong, I'm right. We all do. I've done that for most of my lifetimes. I speak from experience. And that is a hopeless attitude. Only if this selflessness and understanding are perfectly realized, can the immortal infinite release true fulfillment, the only worthy fulfillment, in and through us who are mortal and finite. Organism perishes. That is, limited being, we are all limited beings, limited being consummates in unconditioned non-being. This is one of the mysteries of what is revealed in the deep consciousness which people just don't understand. To them, non-being means annihilation, death, non-existence. This is not so. That which exists is transcendence itself, the totality itself. And that never was born, never ceases to be. See, that is immortal, eternal. And when this particular limited manifestation, this or a book or a table, a house or a country or whatever it is, has run its course and it dies, the manifestation has certainly come to a complete and total end. When I die, there will be no self-consciousness as I am Firoz Mehta left. Absolutely none. It is the transcendent which reabsorbs that which it has put forth. This is rather a hard truth. And I do say it is a truth. It is truth. It is rather hard to accept. We are so conditioned to live, to think, to act in terms of reward and pleasure and so forth, that we cannot accept the fact that when this body, when this psychophysical organism dies, it dies totally and completely. That is to say, it is not annihilated, but that which constituted all the energies and forces and the material, if I may use that word, which constituted the living psychophysical organism, is once again the universal material, the universal spirit, the universal consciousness. If we insist upon our particular perpetuity, we are merely making a noise, a disturbance in that silence which is that divine peace which passes all understanding. And it is futile for us to insist, because we will die. That's all. So it is wise to understand the fact of death and what death really means. Death really means that there is growth taking place. When a child grows, he or she dies to its previous state. It is because we die to our previous state that we live into our new state. You see? Is that clear? And that is how life goes on. But since life in itself is eternal, when this whole organism dissolves altogether, disintegrates and so forth, life itself just goes on. Not as a separate I am I. Organism perishes, yes, I have read that. And it consummates in unconditioned non-being in order that spirit may triumph. The creative spirit is the creative energy, the ultimate creative energy. But when we die, if we have lived the holy life, there is quenchless, brighter light in the world, because the absence of the separate me has been realized. I am an obstruction. I am a little bit of darkness, a shadow upon the light of the world, of the whole universe. But if one purifies oneself completely, one becomes utterly transparent to that transcendent light, and it affects our own life and it affects our whole environment. And in terms of present humanity, in relation to a new kind of being whose emergence lies in the lap of the future, one may venture to imagine a purposiveness related to the above at work. This purposiveness, if unthwarted, may lead to a greater and greater refinement and intensification of the receptive responsive sensitivity, that is our psyche, our psychical sensitivity. The psyche is the limited expression of mind. It will lead to ways of growth unforeseeable at present, of mind's power to penetrate and understand nature and things and beings, and as its climax, to a mutation of mind and body, on account of which a far more complex, advanced and wonderful creation than man, the present existing species, may emerge in the world. So that is one of the purposes of our individual existence, our separate existence as such, to help towards that evolutionary consummation. Now, there is another thing we should understand, that the evolutionary process which has brought into being creatures like ourselves, as I said earlier, is a process which brings the psychophysical organism to maturity. You see? Brings that to maturity. Beyond that, there is the purification of the psyche involved. And the evolutionary process prepares the vehicle, the instrument, if you like, for transcendence. If, for instance, you are a really brilliant musician, executive musician, you want a good instrument, don't you? You want the best instrument that you can possibly obtain in order to make perfect music, beautiful music. Similarly, we are the instruments of transcendence. Transcendence is the musician that plays its particular tune through us, each one individually. And whereas our ordinary music consists of a few parts, four parts or maybe five or six parts of counterpoint which make up the whole harmony, transcendence has countless parts. See, we are one little part, each one of us is one little part of that music to be made. And if we can really be, if the sound that emanates from our being is truly musical and beautiful, then it is transcendence which realizes itself as the true human. And I have said this 100 times if I have said it once. The word human means the happy creator, the being who has trod the way and reached the culmination. So it is transcendence which realizes its humanity through each human being. Now, in this process, there is involved this great question of self-knowledge. And self-knowledge is not to be obtained from others, except insofar as the observation of others increases our own self-knowledge, what we are, you see. Self-knowledge arises if we remain quiet and observant. Remain quiet, especially with the activity of the brain. The brain never stops talking. It is always talking, even in sleep. Some of that talk we experience as dreams. You see? Now the brain never stops talking, but the brain is conditioned and has been conditioned in the evolutionary process for over 40 million years. Because you see, our brains, as I've explained at previous meetings, contain the results of the evolution of the reptiles, the mammals, and the primates. And then we come to man. So this is a heavily conditioned brain. And of course, added to all that evolutionary conditioning, there is the conditioning by our parents, teachers, friends, culture, our circumstances and experiences and so on. So to be quiet means to try and let this turmoil which goes on in the brain subside. We have to let it subside. You can't behave like a policeman, say, and say, now, what are you up to? Stop it. You can't do it that way. Because who is telling me to stop it? Just my own brain. You see? But if this is where breathing quietly does help a little bit, but don't rely upon these external tricks of the trade too much. Just be observant. Be observant of what is going on in the brain and how it is talking back all the time, without stop, at all our sense of experiences, our memories, and so forth. Our fantasies are a marvelous index to what we really are. Particularly, watch all fantasies. They are very, very important. You see, take for instance a man who is a gourmet. His brain will be constantly occupied, thank you. His brain will be constantly occupied with food and enjoying food and this, that and the other, won't it? It's like that. Take the man who is a sex maniac. His brain will be occupied that way, and so on and so on. We can't avoid that sort of thing. But if we observe quietly, without predetermining how it ought to go and how it ought to be, the brain will quieten down. You know, for instance, how, especially when we are children, we are inclined to be fidgety. The body is always, all the time restless. It's fidgety. Well, you can't deliberately prevent that fidgetiness. You can just watch it and let it quieten down. I've seen grown-up people, extraordinarily fidgety. They haven't learned to be still and silent. They just can't do it. And my goodness, the number of people who are non-stop chatterers, they just cannot stop talking. If they are walking up the stairs, they'll still be talking. If they see a cat, they'll start talking to the cat or the dog or whatever it is. We just cannot shut up. And because we cannot shut up, that honey sweet whisper of the voice of transcendence cannot be heard, because we are the noisemakers. You see? So now, it is a case of this quiet observation of all that is going on. Do not condemn it. Do not approve of it. Supposing something is what I approve of at present as good. All right, at present that is as far as I have developed, and it is good for me now. But in 10 years' time, or even less, I will have outgrown this present good, and I will be conscious of a deeper and a greater, a truer good, so to say. Isn't that so? I mean, haven't we noticed that, every one of us in our own lives, that as the years pass, we see deeper and deeper into things. So, do not have a fixation that this is good and that is the last word about it. Not at all. There is no such thing as finality where life, where transcendence is concerned. No such thing as finality. It just goes on and on and on. So, by such observation, one really begins to know oneself. An onlooker, a psychologist, a parent, a friend, can sort of perceive extra from the outside and say, look here, you are so and so, you see, and so forth. Which may be true, but it will be true only in a very limited way. Because he is talking in terms of his perception, which is the result of his own heavily conditioned brain. You see? It may be very helpful. It may be very productive of a useful change, a profitable change. But don't take that for the truth. And when your own vision shows you what you are, don't take that as a final judgment. There is constant growth. As long as we live, we move forward. We have to live. We have to move forward. So take it for the time being, and it will last for a certain time. Now, if we are fortunate enough to realize self-knowledge, become really self-knowing, then one extraordinary result will be this. We shall be free of the illusion that that man is different from me, separate from me. We will be able to see that any person is only another version of myself, and I am only another version of that man. Because fundamentally, well, take the body for instance. Every single human body has a skeleton and muscles, bones, blood, and so forth. Every single human body functions in the same way. The beating of the heart, the flowing of the blood, the activity of the brain, the nerves, and all the rest of it. Isn't that so? So, in which sense are bodies different? In outward appearance, yes. And in the extent to which faculties of that body are concerned. One man can jump 6 feet into the air. I can jump only about 1.5 now. You see? It's like that. So, since this, each body is only another version of any other body, the whole of the psyche, the person himself, is another version of every other person, and so forth. When that happens, it is very much easier to love your neighbor as yourself. Watch your reactions when the news comes on. That awful man, Arthur Scargill. Well, after all, he's only another version of me. He's a big idiot, whereas I'm almost a big idiot. It's like that. And then you see, when one is really conscious that way, there is an extraordinary outflow of loving kindness, of compassion, and love in the real sense. Brotherly love, agape, as it is put in Christian theology. Agape. Agape means brotherly love. But remember that the word agape, the Greek word agape, came into being only with the early Christian community. When Christians were increasing in numbers, they met together in worship in that spirit of brotherly love. Is it not said that if you have a quarrel with a particular man, before you go into the church to pray, outside, talk with him, settle the difference, and go in brotherly love together to pray to God, to that which is transcendent. You see, these are very deep things. Then there is that other word, charis. Charis has several meanings. In the first instance, it means favor, a favorable appearance or complexion or whatever it is. It means grace. The Latin gratia is related to this word. We know the word charisma, and this person is a very charismatic person. There is a social unity involved in that condition. It also means kindness, it also means goodwill, it also means beauty. It's one of the interesting things, charis. Agape and charis have played a very great part in Christian theology. Now, it will soon be Christmas, Christ's Mass. How do people approach Christmas the world over? Rather wildly, rather stormily. How many people drink too much, have collisions with cars and whatnot? And there's death and destruction in as the result. How much exploitation of the populace goes on by those who exploit the big shops and so on and so on. How much hypocrisy there is about it all. Instead of it being an opportunity for peace and goodwill and quiet, of turning over a new life, I mean turning over a new leaf and entering into a profounder state of life, it's this wild pursuit of pleasure. It's the reptilian brain, the brain of the primate and the mammal at work. There are good elements also. I don't deny that at all. But the good elements are so overlaid with the unfortunate, unhappy elements that Christmas, as celebrated by the hundreds of millions, is not Christmas at all. It is the traditional date for the birth of Christ. What is Christ? Who is Christ? The anointed Holy One. The perfected Holy One. The emergence of this Christ consciousness, which is the same really as talking of the emergence of the Buddha nature in oneself, or of Asha in Zarathustrian language, and so on, you see. This emergence of the Christ consciousness is the thing which is really being celebrated. But it must necessarily be celebrated in terms of contemplation and peace, prayer, acts of goodwill, fellow feeling, and so on. And the ending of all our absurd conflicts and struggles and so on. And when that happens, the real merriment begins. This merriment, this happiness, is a very positive thrilling throughout the psychical atmosphere of the world. You know the good old song, Ding Dong Merrily on High. And on high refers, of course, to those realms of creation which are devoid of all material manifestation as we know them, as we know material manifestation. And this merriment, this happiness, is a profound source of spiritual strength, of moral support, and all that is really worthy and best in life. And that is the real meaning of, to me at least, of Merry Christmas. And it is in that sense that I wish you all a Merry Christmas. A happy Christmas, so that you find your own true fulfillment naturally and spontaneously. Thank you.